Congressman and former presidential candidate Ron Paul. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
It's nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, let's get one thing out of the way right at the top. You have a website, correct?
That is correct.
And the name of the website?
CampaignForLiberty.com.
Okay, great. We'll talk more about that later. But right at the top, I have one question for you. We're going to talk later, but my first question is, you know, it seemed to me that of all the candidates, when you were running for president, you definitely had the most fun.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, what we were doing was exciting, and we had a good reception. It made us have a lot of fun.
A morning with Dr. Radical, Congressman Ron Paul, the most fun of the presidential candidates, at the very least, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 31st. Also today, the economy. Wall Street is on an upswing. We'll take a closer look. Cuba, changes the new president is making, cosmetic or substantive. And the struggling economy has triggered lots of cancellations. Summer school to music festivals. We're making a soundtrack. Those stories and all the news.
The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has announced he will not stand for re-election as leader of his party in September and will step down when a successor is chosen. Olmert's been under investigation for allegations of corruption. He's denied any wrongdoing. The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan says he will step down in efforts to heal the country's political divisions after an attempt to have his AK party banned failed narrowly in the Constitutional Court. Not enough of the 11 judges backed the chief prosecutor's submission that the AK, which Erdogan heads, has Islamic roots and was undermining Turkey's secular constitution.
Today, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House will unveil a major overhaul of intelligence powers. The changes will boost the powers of the Director of National Intelligence. President Bush signed an executive order updating spy powers yesterday. The government says it finally confirmed that the recent salmonella outbreak was caused by raw serrano and jalapeno peppers from Mexico. The FDA's food safety chief is David Ackerton.
We learned that we had got a positive sample in both the water used for irrigation and a sample of serrano peppers from the same farm that matched the outbreak strain of Salmonella St. Paul.
The Mexican government is challenging the sampling methods used. The House has passed a bill that would adopt the toughest lead standards in the world for products aimed at kids 12 or younger. It would also strengthen rules for testing children's products. The Senate might approve the bill by Friday.
Barack Obama begins in Cedar Rapids, Iowa today. John McCain's in Racine, Wisconsin. Oil jumped more than $4 a barrel overnight, but it's still pretty low comparatively, $126 a barrel. The Dow gained more than 1.5% yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 1284. If you have a question for Congressman Ron Paul, go to our website, mytake@thetakeaway.org, or call us at 877-8-MYTAKE. We're going to be talking to him. We'll put your questions to the congressman and former presidential candidates. Also, what's your playlist, your music playlist for economic hard times? Is it Beyond Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? We want to hear your songs at 877-8-MYTAKE. mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'd take Jay-Z. That's a hard knock life.
It's a hard knock
life. Hear that a lot on the radio.
Life.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 31st, and the markets are poised to open ahead this morning. And the stock market's been a bit on a tide turner, which is it's been a bit higher in the past couple of days, maybe because of lower oil prices, perhaps because of President Bush's signing of a huge housing package that gives the Treasury Department wide latitude to safeguard the country's two largest finance companies, and of course will also help thousands of troubled borrowers. The Treasury Department also announcing an extension of its emergency lending program. Joining us now is Cheryl Einhorn to parse through all of this economic news, our Takeaway economic guru and adjunct professor of business, economic, and financial journalism at Columbia University. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Why is the market feeling confident? Are they backing the steps that the Bush administration has been taking to shore up this struggling economy?
Well, I think we certainly have seen some signs that financial stocks have been getting a boost. Yesterday, they did very nicely as a result of this. But, you know, we're really seeing sort of a tale of two markets here. We've seen that almost every energy company, all 39 energy producers in the Standard & Poor's 500 index went up yesterday, and the stock market went up yesterday, even though crude oil prices went up, which is a real counterindicator. Usually when crude oil prices have been rallying, the stock market has been declining. And I think it'll be interesting to see today whether or not there's any follow-through now that the Federal Reserve has decided to extend the discount window and the subsidized lending to the investment banks through the end of the year.
And this is also happening at the same time where you had some major companies who were reporting earnings, and it really was a mixed bag when you take a look at Disney, Starbucks, and some others. You want to lay that out for us?
Sure. You know, the Starbucks numbers, it was their first loss. And they're going to be laying off thousands of people, and they're closing, I think, over 600 stores.
And all over the world, not
all
just
over
here
the world.
In the United States.
That's right, not just here. And although they've had efforts to try to really shore up the company, what they're seeing is slower traffic. And yet a company like Disney, which is also discretionary income, really did very well. There didn't seem to be a slowdown at the U.S. parks. Mm-hmm. California was a little bit slower, but they've raised the rate, the hotel rate, and so they've been able to make up some of the decreased spending in the parks because of the increased hotel rates.
You know, growth seems to persist. There's a lot of contradictory messages in the economy, yet there's this extraordinary volatility in the markets. You've got a 15% drop in oil prices over the last 2 weeks. A two-day drop that was unprecedented in the history of the oil markets. How do you keep track of the signal versus the noise here in all this up-down movement?
I think that's a very good question. And I think that it's probably not a good idea to pay too much attention to some of these individual small moves. You want to look over a longer period of time to get a sense of where is sentiment. And I think the volatility we're seeing now is that there's not a clear direction. Today, I think we're going to get some important information about the economy because we're going to have the gross domestic product number coming out this morning for the second quarter, and we'll also have revisions for the earlier periods. And that will give us a good sign, because the last couple of revisions have been downward. The fourth quarter gross domestic product number was up an anemic 0.6 percentage points. If we get a revision down, we could actually end up with a negative number for that. So I think that's something that could clearly have a big impact going forward and an impact on how the government continues to view the actions that it's taking.
I'm so glad you said that, because we're always told, us lay people, to take a look at the market over the long term. But yet and still, the market reacts to every little thing that happens every single day. So as John said, not only on the smaller, in terms of the individual reporting numbers, is there this contradiction, but that notion of thinking long, how do you do that? And how do companies do that? Because people on the market aren't.
Well, I think for companies, there's a lot of pressure on them to make all these quarterly estimates that are out there. And, you know, companies, though, don't manage their business for a quarter. They manage it for a much longer term. And I think that if there's some way to try to get past some of this individual noise to say, you know, how is it doing in the longer term? What are some of the trends that the companies are actually seeing in terms of demand for their products? I think it's a much healthier way to get a sense of what's going on.
You know, we talk about the global economy so much on this program, and the dollar really has dropped precipitously over the last year. And I'm wondering if that represents a kind of a fundamental realignment of the U.S. currency in global markets that's going to change our calculation of inflation, our calculation of exports, and that really we're looking at a whole new territory now.
Well, I think it definitely is, because as the dollar has slipped, we become poorer as a nation, and as our interest rates are very low, there's much less impetus for foreign countries to put their money into the U.S. dollar because the returns are less. And I think that clearly this has very long-term ramifications if we can't shore up our currency.
Cheryl Einhorn, we're going to ask you to stick around for a moment. Cheryl Einhorn, our takeaway economic guru and adjunct professor of business, economic, and financial journalism at Columbia University, is going to stay with us.
And we want to remind you that Congress Congressman Ron Paul, former presidential candidate, is also with us. We're going to be speaking with him at some length momentarily. But if you have a question for Ron Paul, go to our website, mytakeatthetakeaway.org, or 877-8-MY-TAKE. Leave your question there. As we said, Ron Paul joined us at the top of the hour. He's with us on the phone from Washington. As the Republican convention gets going in Minnesota in September, down the street, Ron Paul's Campaign for Liberty, a rally for Congressman Paul's coalition of conservatives, will also be convening. Congressman Paul joins us from Washington on the phone. What do you mean to accomplish at your convention in September? And thanks for staying with us.
Well, the title of the meeting we have is a rally for the Republic, and that's exactly what we wanted to do. We want it to be very positive. We want to talk about what's happened last year or so, the attention that we got through the campaign on issues that, generally speaking, neither candidate has or are willing to talk about. And we want it to be very positive. It's not there to confront or obstruct or disturb the other convention, but it's to get our people together to celebrate and actually have some fun.
Yeah, we were talking about the economy a moment ago. You, if there was a Ron Paul administration, in the first 100 days would make a run at getting rid of the Federal Reserve and the IRS. That would certainly change the economy, right?
Yes, it would, but realistically speaking, you can't do that in 30 days or even 1 year. But the intent of doing that, if you were moving in that direction, would have a very positive effect on the economy. If all of a sudden you knew you didn't have to pay any income tax, your income would go way up immediately, and you would be so much better off. And as far as getting rid of the Federal Reserve, it was never intended that we have a central bank, and we've had it through our entire history, only since 1913. We've had a lot of ups and downs. But my idea about getting rid of the Federal Reserve is actually to have a parallel monetary standard and phase it out instead of closing it down one day. That would be chaotic. But if we continue to do what we're doing and destroy the dollar, that is going to be a lot more chaotic, and I think that's what we're moving toward. And other countries have experienced that when a currency is destroyed, because you end up with very, very high interest rates and possibly even runaway inflation.
Let me ask you a couple of very quick questions regarding the campaign, just to get them out of the way. You are not endorsing, even though you are a Republican, John McCain, correct?
No, I am not. His views are so different than mine, and although I feel comfortable in the Republican Party believing in limited government, actually I think I'm closer to what the Republicans profess to believe in. I can't endorse somebody that contradicts everything I've stood for and worked for 30 years.
Barack Obama supports you or is close to your position on the war. True or false?
Partially true. What he says is closer, and his statements are much closer than John McCain's. But I've never heard him say bring all the troops home from the Middle East. And he's never taken off the options off the table by Iran. He talks militantly about Iran, that we have to have all options on the table. He wants to put more troops in Afghanistan. So he's not very close to the traditional non-interventionist foreign policy that George Washington, the early presidents, talked about. I think we should give up on the empire and we should bring our troops home, and our country would be better off, because the Soviets had to give up their empire and they disintegrated. And I think that will happen to us. We will come home, but I don't want to have the destruction of our financial system and have to come home under those conditions. I'd like to just come home now.
Ron, Paul, one quick question for you. Campaign for Liberty, if you're not confronting, why have it the exact same week as the Republican convention? And we just have a few seconds.
Well, confronting to me is like disrupting and demonstrate and try to take over the convention. I think philosophically we're very much confronting and setting a standard and an option, and that's where the people are, that's where the media will be.
At the very least, Ron Paul, you'll be siphoning conservatives away from that Republican convention. We'll talk about more about that after some headlines. We'll be back with you in the next segment. Ron Paul, representative from Texas and former Republican presidential candidate. Stay with us.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Thursday, July 31st, and we're talking about a soundtrack for economic hard times. What's the song you listen to when you're trying to procrastinate and not pay your bills? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. A soundtrack for economic tough times. John?
Soundtrack playlist. I like that. The hard times playlist soundtrack. We're continuing our conversation with Congressman and former presidential candidate Ron Paul, who's on the line with us from Washington. If you have a question for Ron Paul, you can reach us via Twitter, also 877-8-MY-TAKE and mytake@thetakeaway.org. Congressman Paul, we were talking a moment ago about the idea that your convention and your mobilization of conservatives, and there will be 18,000, we believe, at your event in Minneapolis, that this does siphon conservative votes away from the Republican Party. You're, you know, really a bullet in the heart of John McCain's candidacy, it seems.
Well, it is a challenge, and it's meant to be a challenge, hopefully, you know, influencing what the Republican Party, you know, stands for. But I'm not a candidate. They're not going to be voting for me. But it is true that if they come to the same realization that there's no difference between the two candidates, then they might pick a third candidate or a fourth candidate and vote in another way. Or they might not vote at all. But just to vote for one candidate over the other, and their foreign policy being essentially the same, and they don't care about monetary policy, and they're not talking about really having concern about these deficits and the financial situation we're in, I think that's a very worthy goal to call attention to the American people of how serious this is.
You said on the floor of the House about a month ago that you believe that the volatility we're seeing in the markets is a sign of some sort of global economic chaos that you described in the most dire of terms. Do you believe that we're headed for some sort of economic catastrophe?
Well, I don't know whether I'll use that word, but I think if we don't straighten up, yes, it could be very, very bad, because I see this financial problem that we face today different than anything we've ever had in our history, because we've been globalized, and the globalization is sometimes very good, but if it's based on malinvestment and debt and a currency that is not sound, which is the dollar. See, the dollar's been the reserve currency since the breakdown of the Bretton Woods Agreement, when the currency did have some backing. After 71, there was no backing. So we've been allowed to create money out of thin air and spend it overseas, so we didn't have to work so hard to maintain our standard of living. So our standard of living has been higher than we've deserved, and people took our dollars. Now they're starting to take our dollars less enthusiastically, and this problem is not going to just be in the United States. Already we see that even in Europe, and they've lived beyond their means, and actually the euro has been stronger than the dollar. But I wouldn't invest in the euro, because I think their situation is just as bad, because they've been willing to buy our dollars and inflate their own currency, as well as in China. So I see it as a global problem. The market's demanding a correction and a liquidation of debt and a malinvestment, and that's when the pain and suffering will come.
Ron Paul, we have a question for you from one of our listeners. Take a listen to this, please.
To Senator Paul, I'd say, sir, you are a breath of fresh air in today's political scene. Second, when I was in school, I remember the definition of communism was basically where the state owned all land and there's a centralized economy. I would ask Senator Paul, it seems to me like we are living in a socialist republic in America today, because with the property taxes that we have, we basically rent our land from the government, as well as our stoves, our refrigerators, our cars, and everything else. Are we living in a socialist republic, Senator Paul? Thank you.
You got a little promotion there, Ron. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks a lot. In a way, we are. We're moving in that direction. I use the word corporatism and fascism. They don't have title to our land, but they have control of our land. Our government now owns more than one-third of all the land in this country. In the early years, we were transferring land from the federal government into private ownership. Now we're going in the other direction. But he's right to indicate that the control is with the government. government. We can't do anything without permission, and we are taxed. We do pay rent, and this is true throughout, whether it's the military-industrial complex. Our medical system is not socialism per se, but it's sort of corporatism because the corporations run our medical care, and that's why it's a disaster. The banking system is run by corporations and government agency and a secret Federal Reserve, so it is a form of socialism, but I say we're moving in the direction of fascism, where corporations and governments are in bed together.
Congressman, let's talk about you and your runs for president. 20 years ago, you did it with the Libertarian Party, and this year you set all kinds of records, not only online, but in raising money, and you developed a really hardcore base of loyalists. Do you think it's because of the internet, or do you think it's because of your politics, given where we are in history right now, that you've really, that your campaign evolved as it did?
I think it's both. I think the time was right. I was not certain of that, certainly, you know, at the beginning, because I was very reluctant to do this, believing it would take another generation to educate people along the lines of true liberty and why we should follow the Constitution. But to my surprise, there was a welcomed audience out there, because I think people are ahead of the government and they realize there's a big problem. Young people know they can't pay all these bills and they don't like our foreign policy, so the reception was much greater than I anticipated. But the spreading of the message certainly wasn't through the help of the evening news on TV, because if I did get on there, it was usually to marginalize what I was doing, even in the debates. But a lot of people recognized there was a difference. They went to the website. The fundraising was not done by us. People come to me and they want me to teach them how to raise funds on the internet and give me their give them my email list. Well, that doesn't work that way. These people got together. They formed their meetup groups. There were 1,750 meetup groups, and they were the campaign. They did the campaigning. They organized.
Well, certainly, Congressman, you've touched a chord, but you also discovered in the course of your candidacy that there's a fairly hard ceiling to the extent to which your ideas will penetrate into the mainstream. Before we go, I want to give you a little present that we made for you when we were doing some electoral specials. We made a ringtone for your campaign, basically spinning off something that happened to the Barack Obama campaign. Listen to this, and then we'll say goodbye to you, all right? Thanks for joining us, Congressman.
Thank you.
Ron Paul. Ron Paul. Ron Paul. He's the truest of them all.
Congressman, that is available on our website if you want to download it.
Does that work for you, Congressman? Did it work for you?
We're going to let everybody know about your website today and see how many people come listen.
All right, great. Ron Paul, Congressman from Texas. I'd love to ask some of his constituents what they think about the gold standard. He's also a former Republican presidential candidate and running the Campaign for Liberty, which begins August 31st through September 2nd in Minneapolis. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're putting together the official comprehensive Hard Times playlist. Send us your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 27 minutes to the hour, Mike McConnell, Director of National Intelligence, will be getting more power over foreign intelligence, according to the Wall Street Journal. The paper is reporting that the Bush administration will unveil a major overhaul of U.S. intelligence powers today. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who will step down in September, says he's innocent of the corruption charges against him. He's accused of a long list of financial misdeeds, including taking cash-stuffed envelopes from an American businessman. President Bush is tripling U.S. spending to fight AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis in the world's poorest countries. The new bill authorizes $48 billion in aid over the next 5 years. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan says he will try to heal his country's political divisions now that a court has ruled his party won't be banned because of its Islamist roots. and UN peacekeeping forces are stretched to the limit. That's the warning from their outgoing director, Jean-Marie Gaynaud. He says that the Blue Helmets are in dire need of new resources if their world policing work is to continue. And that's a look at your domestic and international headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
John?
Yes.
You're going to throw it at me?
Yeah, Adora. Now we have show from Adora Udoji.
Cheryl Einhorn is still with us, our takeaway economic guru and adjunct professor of business, economic, and financial journalism at Columbia University. And we're going to talk about Cuba because we're marking a 2-year anniversary since Raul Castro took the reins of power there in Cuba from his ailing brother Fidel. In that time, Raul has instituted a string of economic reforms, for example, made it legal for Cubans to own cell phones and introduced the notion of bonus pay for government workers, among other things. Washington has dismissed these changes as cosmetic. The question is, are they? For more, we turn now to the BBC's Havana correspondent, Michael Voss. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Adora.
Are these changes that Raul Castro is making, are they cosmetic?
No, I think they're small, but they are symbolic. I mean, he's putting through gradual changes, step by step, and if things aren't working, let's adapt or change them if necessary. But he's being flexible. He's saying, you know, he's not sticking to dogma. Fidel would traditionally have said, you know, if things aren't working, we need more revolutionary spirit. People must try harder. Raul Castro is saying, well, maybe we should change things. Maybe if it's not working, people can't always earn the same. Doctors don't need to earn the same as road cleaners. People can have bonuses based on productivity. And if Cuba's having to import half its food because the farms aren't working, then let's give unused state land to private farmers. It's slow, small steps. It's not the sort of opening we've seen in China or Vietnam yet, but he's moving cautiously towards it.
But the ideas are certainly radical. We're talking about a country where the average age is somewhere around 38 years old. How are Cubans feeling about Raul and the changes and the future?
I think the thing that Raul gave people here was expectations and hope that things are going to improve. I mean, his priority really is to make sure that the Communist Party stays in power, that this one-party state survives. There's no signs of any political reforms. But he believes that if he can do this, if he puts more money in people's pockets and more food on the table. And generally, people are going along with that. They're a pretty patient people, the Cubans, and I think this is a long-term plan. Some senior people I've been talking to are saying, oh, don't expect major changes in 1 or 2 years. Let's talk about a five-year time span. And the big question is how slowly can it go without really disillusioning people? And that's not clear yet.
Is Fidel Castro, who ruled for so many decades with an iron fist, is he still wielding any power behind the scenes from what you understand?
Oh, he's still hanging in there. I mean, officially, Raul would say that Fidel Castro knows and approves what's going on. It's very difficult to tell, but certainly he makes his presence felt through regular newspaper columns, and he writes lots of articles, a lot of them rambling, a lot of them looking back at history. I mean, recently there's been one on the Korean conflict, another on Cuba's Olympic baseball team. He doesn't write much about domestic politics, but he does seem to snipe at the edges. I mean, when Raul Castro lifted restrictions on people buying mobile phones and DVDs and things, Fidel wrote an article against the evils of consumerism. It's that
now,
sort
of
sniping.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, are the brothers
yes.
fighting a bit? I mean, it seems a little tit for tat there.
It's very difficult to tell. This is one thing they're very tight-lipped about. You have to sort of read carefully between the lines. I mean, the other week, Raul Castro issued a presidential decree giving incentives to retired teachers to go back to work because there's a real crisis in the schools. Fidel writes an article saying, you know, our education system isn't as bad as everybody makes out.
Sounds
there is
a little,
this sort of sniping. Yes,
sounds
John?
A little like good cop, bad cop there, maybe. Give me a sense of Raul's regional aspirations. Certainly Fidel thought of himself as the big confronter of the power to the north. Any sort of sign of a relationship with Brazil or Uribe in Colombia or Hugo Chavez?
Yes, I mean, I think Raul is not the great international leader. He's almost never traveled abroad in his life, and since taking over the presidency, he sent other people to all the major meetings like the UN. But they are developing a much closer alliance around the Americas. in Latin America. There's a lot of sort of soft diplomacy going on. The Cubans are sending doctors and eye specialists and education specialists to teach adult literacy all over Latin America. He's forged very strong ties, as Fidel did with Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, building good relations with Bolivia. And there is a sort of string of left-wing governments now in Latin America, from Nicaragua to Bolivia, the Cubans work very closely with. Also forging strong ties with China. China's giving Cuba very soft credits to buy things like buses and fridges and electrical goods. So there's another strong alliance. And in fact, the Russians were here this week, and I think they're trying to mend relations too.
You know, you've mentioned some interesting incremental changes, like the concept of the productivity bonuses and the mobile phone sales. Is there any way to measure how many people are taking advantage of these things? Is there any way to measure whether productivity has increased or how many of these bonuses have been given out?
These are very early days yet. In terms of bonuses, no, there's been no figures at all. The initial take up on things like mobile phones wasn't that great, but we know that sort of 8,000 were sold in the first week. They make the announcement, you hear about it, and then they issue a decree, and then it starts to move. I mean, I've only met one farmer so far who's actually got extra land, but there appears to be a lot in the pipeline.
So it's really Michael Voss, a wait and see situation. And we thank you always for your insightful updating for us about what's happening in Cuba. Thank you.
You're welcome, Adora.
That's Michael Voss, the BBC correspondent in Havana, and the questioner there was Cheryl Einhorn, our takeaway economic guru and adjunct professor of business, economic, and financial journalism at Columbia University. Thank you, Cheryl.
Long honeymoon for Raul there, it seems like.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, folks. It's Thursday. It's July 31st, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okay. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there, and it's 12 minutes to the hour. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert will step down in September. He insists he's innocent of the corruption charges against him and says it'll be easier to defend himself as a private citizen. President Bush has tripled U.S. spending to fight AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis in the world's poorest countries. The new bill authorizes $48 billion in aid over the next 5 years. The Mexican government says that an FDA report tracing the recent salmonella outbreak to a pepper farm in Mexico isn't valid. It says that the FDA sampled water that's not actually used for irrigation at the farm. Iraqi police say that a suicide car bomb attack has killed 3 people and wounded 4 others near the northern city of Mosul. And finally, if you don't want to know what the Olympic opening ceremony is going to be like, cover your ears right now. Korean TV network broadcasts footage of a dress rehearsal, and China is absolutely fuming. The Olympic Committee in China is very embarrassed because the whole opening ceremony was supposed to be a secret. Now, our crack news team actually found that little piece of video online. So let me just set the scene. First of all, we have the big booming drums and a countdown to the beginning of the Olympics. There's just 30 seconds of footage, and then you see this beautiful old Chinese scroll unfurl, and inside is a single gymnast doing ballet. Now, I'm not going to do any more of a spoiler
for you. You have it in for the Chinese. Yesterday it was all Amnesty International. Now we're going to annoy them by, like, blowing and outing their opening ceremony.
It was truly beautiful. I only saw 30 seconds. I can't wait to August the 8th and see the rest.
If I ever go to Beijing, I'm going to be arrested because I'm associated with this show.
I'm sorry. I just
really
love
more
the Olympics.
Of a primer, though, yes. Right? It's just going to leave us wanting more.
Right. Absolutely. Thank really you, beautiful. Check it out online if you can find it.
All right, we are going to have some fun now, folks. We have been asking all hour long and really all day today, what's your playlist for economic hard times? You can still send your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Everyone's hurting because of hard times. Music is people's companion during hard times. But imagine if you were a musician in the middle of hard times and had to deal with high fuel prices on your bus traveling around the country, or station wagon. You're lucky, I suppose, if you have a bus. Which got us to thinking, you know, maybe we ought to get Jack the Martini Cowboy Grace, our buddy Jack Grace, into the studio. First talk about the music industry and how they're dealing with hard times, and then actually get involved in this whole hard times playlist business. Jack, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's definitely a different time. Everyone's getting hit from the bottom and to the top. It's a changing time for every musician.
How do musicians deal with these raised expenses? Because I can't imagine the ticket prices are going up that much.
Denial is a really great effective way of dealing with it.
That works. Yeah. Well, you've talked to some musicians and some people around the country who are having some very tangible difficulties. Let's hear some of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, there's the legendary Wayne Hancock is somebody who he sort of made a vow that when gas went to $4.50, he was bailing.
But he was bailing.
And then
quitting the business.
That was his talk when gas was around 3-something. And then, sure enough, $4.50 came, and what was he supposed to do? So at this point, sure enough, Wayne Hancock has this to say.
The last time I was spending like $400-$500 on a week for fuel. So it's got to be, it's almost twice as much, right? I know a lot of people are running scared, but we got through the Great Depression. We'll get through this one too, you know, because out here everything is music comes first, right? You know, so you got to keep gas in your car.
I can hear a song lyric in that misery right there.
I was
there.
Just thinking because he's Willie Nelson. What doesn't Willie Nelson call him, you told us?
He says he calls Wayne Hancock one of the true greats of country music. Hmm.
Now, one of your jobs, aside from being a professional musician and our buddy here on The Takeaway, is you're a booking agent.
I also book some clubs in New York City. Yeah, absolutely. I've had 7 cancellations between the two venues for August alone.
And that's because of just expenses and...
Yeah, it's just every time people just say, we just can't make this work, and we know we can't ask you for any more money. It's not like our rent's getting any cheaper here.
What about other booking agents around the country?
They are all coming up with different strategies. Some people are actually shearing away from picking up baby acts, as they say, and going with the safe ones. Where out west, there's people like Nancy Fly, who has to deal with a much bigger range from Texas in distances and such.
Instead of bands thinking that they have to travel all over the United States to play gigs, they may pick out a territory and play within a few state region. We're going to be able to, over time, see a difference in the different regional qualities of the music. I'm looking for that to be an interesting side effect of the gas price.
That's optimistic. Of course, we could also go to like teleconferencing music, and that would be horrible and awful.
It's not quite the same as a live performance.
Right. But perhaps the best story and maybe the best sort of song to tee off our playlist for hard times comes from Ralph Stanley.
Ah, good old Ralph Stanley. Yeah, there's a great song, and he just did some traveling himself where he went from West Virginia to Texas and back just to play a couple of shows. His gas price alone was about
$2,000. $2,000.
Oh, there's a song.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days.
Just a little more.
So we begin the Hard Times playlist with Ralph Stanley's Man of Constant Sorrow, especially when you're looking at the gas prices on his trip. But Jack Grace is helping to curate our playlist. But Barbara wrote into our site with this theme song for Hard Times, Dire Straits, Money for Nothing.
We got to install microwave ovens, custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs.
And our friend Anthony, well, he called in to tell us what he's listening to.
Hey, good morning. This is Anthony from Brewster. The song I'm listening to right now is Phil Collins. I don't care no more.
Don't care anymore. You can tell everybody about the state I'm in. You won't catch me.
Wow.
Watch out for Anthony wandering around up there in Brewster, New York. You've got a couple of tunes that you brought in, Jack. What have you got?
Yeah, it seems I'm going to move out of the economic despair of the 80s that everyone seems to be feeling there and think about Lefty Frizzell singing, "If You Got the Money, I've Got the Time." And the outro of that goes, "If you run short of money, I run short of time. If you're out of money, honey, I'm out of time."
So if you're wishing for work that you don't have, you might turn to this tune from Dolly Parton.
Working 9 to 5.
More 80s music.
Adora, get us out of the 80s.
I see. I mentioned Jay-Z, and miraculously, there is Jay-Z. I've been hearing this one a lot, Hard Knock Life.
That song actually made it big on our covers show that we did a few weeks back. One of the finest covers.
I flow for those drooled out. All my niggas locked down in a 10x4, controlling the house. We live in hard knocks.
And that would be in the 90s.
Yeah,
what about
go.
The what about oh, you know, I got another 80s here.
Yeah.
I kind of can't resist this one though.
Sure.
Donna Summer, She Works Hard for the Money.
I think we're only pushing even late 70s,
yeah.
So I think you're okay.
Late 70s?
Yeah.
Yeah, there actually was a recession in the late 70s.
Yeah,
pretty
yeah.
Miserable in the late 70s. What other songs do you have, Jack?
Well, I like to go back to the old classic Hank Williams, of course. I mean, he's got plenty of them, but it's like, "Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer." It's always those.
Oh,
that's
my.
Great. It's always those.
You can't buy beer.
Well, you can send if you can't buy beer.
That's bad.
Oh, Adora's shaking here in the studio. A little tremble there. 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can send your playlist suggestions to us. We're going to be taking these suggestions and airing them all morning long. Also, mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're always on here at The Takeaway. You can find us online streaming at Friend Feed on Facebook. Come around to thetakeaway.org. Today we had a chat with Texas Congressman Ron Paul. You'll want to hear that.
And we're talking about playlists, as John just ran through, and John, Jack, and myself did, and it's a Hard Knock Life. I like that one. What's your Hard Knock song? Jordan Band wrote in with his take. He says, "I'd suggest A Dollar Ain't a Dollar Anymore" by Tom Glaser, and boy, he would be right about that.
Yep.
Or maybe Dirty Old Town by Ewan McCall. Is that right? Although I prefer the Pogues.
Oh, the Pogues. I love it. Let's hear.
Dirty Old Town.
Oh, yeah.
Dirty Old Town. Clouds are dread.
The Pogues are all about hard times.
And there you go, Jordan. We played your song. We want to hear from you. Send us your playlist for hard times. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always drop us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Can we go out on that Tom Waits? Let's do it.
Money can spare a dime.
Public radio station with a slogan like that, huh?
Yeah, that's nice.
Don't you remember you called me out?
Tom Waits singing, "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" Thanks to all of us who joined us. Jack's going to stay with us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
This economy, Jack.
Don't get me started.
In this depressing economy, they've canceled flights and festivals, government programs and plans.
School field trips, sports and classes, libraries, museums, gardens and concerts.
In this economy, to hell with their fans. Why, they've canceled fireworks, picnics, pensions, bankers, thousands of factory jobs. What can I say? Jack,
oh.
I just thought of it.
Yeah.
Is it possible they might actually cancel The Takeaway?
Ooh,
Nah.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 31st. And John, is that a mandolin?
It's a mandolin.
That you're holding? That was you and Jack
Grace,
the martini cowboy.
Yeah.
Singing that opening song, because today we're going to take a look at how the fragile economy is triggering cancellations from school programs to musical tours, concerts, as John just said. We're making a soundtrack for those hard times. Also, oil, and more oil prices were down this week, and now they're up. Why these highs and lows? The federal government says big drops in the number of homeless Americans across the country. We'll explore those numbers and the very serious problem of the Truman Show delusion, a mental illness. Those stories and more.
After months of battling corruption allegations, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert addressed his country on national TV yesterday to say he'll stand down as a successor in his Kadima party when it's chosen in September.
I will decide that I will not take place in the primaries of Kadima party. Therefore, I'm not going to take part in the internal elections in the party, as was decided by me, and I will accept their results with a blessing.
Olmert has denied any wrongdoing and corruption charges against him and says it'll be easier to fight the charges as a private citizen. The Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Erdogan, says he's going to work to heal political divisions after his AK party was nearly banned in the Constitutional Court. Not enough of the 11 judges agreed the AK, which has Islamist roots, was undermining Turkey's secular constitution.
Today, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House will unveil a major overhaul of intelligence powers. The changes will boost the powers of the Director of National Intelligence. The post is currently held by Mike McConnell. President Bush signed an executive order updating spy powers yesterday. Iraqi police say a suicide car bomb attack has killed three policemen and wounded four others near the northern city of Mosul. It comes a day after an al-Qaeda-fronted organization said it would start a campaign of attacks in Mosul in revenge for the killing of fellow militants.
In politics, Barack Obama begins in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. John McCain's in Racine, Wisconsin. Oil jumped more than $4 a barrel overnight, $126 a barrel. The S&P 500, after a jump yesterday, begins trading at 1284. What is your playlist for hard times? And it probably doesn't include that little song Jack
you
and I wrote.
You just had
at the
to
top.
Do that, yeah. Right, with your little mandolin.
This is the end of the mandolin for the hour, okay? All right, I'm putting it down. Put down the mandolin, Mr. Hockenberry.
Step away.
Put down, yeah, step away. Anyway, you can reach us with your playlist ideas for the playlist for hard times, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also seriously talking about Guantanamo Bay and Cuba and the oil prices, all that coming up in the show.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Lots of economic news, and we begin with the economy today in a moment. But I just want to remind you all, we are assembling a master American playlist for hard times. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Weigh in with the rest of the nation. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We will add your song to the playlist. Adora?
And John, it's just as you've reported, overnight oil prices jumped $4 to nearly $127 a barrel. And that's still down from highs a few weeks ago. Also this week, President Bush was talking to some electric company employees about why more offshore oil drilling, will help the struggling oil markets.
People say, well, it's not going to instantly change the problem. You're right, it's not. There's no magic wand. But it'll certainly send a clear signal to the markets that the United States is no longer going to sit on the sideline.
It certainly did send a message, and we've seen prices dip and now up. Bush wants Congress to take a last-minute vote on offshore drilling since he needs that approval to move forward. But Lisa Marganelli, our friend and author of Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank, that's not likely to happen, is it, that vote?
It doesn't look like it. It looks like the clock is kind of running out on it.
How do you dissect this up and down, this volatility in the oil markets?
Well, I think it's just that we don't really know what the reality of oil's price is because we don't know how people are going to behave. And consumers have been drawing back on the amount of oil that they use. Almost everybody's changed their habits. And that's what sent oil prices down. They fell about $20 a barrel. And I think what the blip upwards yesterday was the result of inventories that held by refiners being low. And we still don't know whether that really indicates that people are going to go back to their old habits and guzzle gas with abandon. I doubt it.
And what's your take on President Bush's announcing that he would lift the executive ban on offshore drilling? Does it really have an effect of how people in the market are viewing what's happening in the oil world right now?
No. I think what this is it's politics. And it also has to do with profits for the oil companies. First of all, creating kind of a standoff over drilling. Drilling is really popular with voters when oil prices are high. And so sort of showing that that Congress won't move and that he wants to move makes him look good. But, you know, the U.S. only has 3% of the world's oil reserves, and we use 25% of the world's production. This isn't going to have an effect in the short term, and it's not going to have an effect in the long term. And I would argue that we're better off leaving that oil in the ground until 20, 25, 30 years from now when it's worth a lot more and we want to pull it out and use it for petrochemicals.
That's the net effect of our strategic petroleum reserve policy. We essentially pump it back into the ground and then we sell it for a higher price. But as far as helping us strategically, it certainly doesn't do much of that. I'm interested in any sort of speculator role in this serious decline in the oil price and now a spike back up. Do you see anything like that?
You know, it's hard to know what the speculators are doing. One thing about the Democratic proposal for to curb speculation is that it involves more oversight and more number gathering. Then we have some idea of what the role of speculators is. Generally, speculators keep the market going, and they have to play against the kind of fundamentals of what consumers are doing and what the oil supply is. So are speculators driving it up? I have no idea. Every Wednesday, the figures on the amount of oil that's held by refiners in the tanks outside their refineries comes out. And, you know, over the past 30 years with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the amount of oil that's held by the refiners has declined. And the more oil the refiners are holding in their tanks, the cheaper prices are. So, you know, one thing we could do is we could require that refiners hold more oil in their tanks and see if that would buffer prices.
Interesting.
And they've, of course, we should know if these oil companies have made record profits this year. And if I'm just, an ordinary citizen like myself, how should I be viewing this price swing back and forth and looking forward? Is there any way to have some sense of where we're going to be, like even, say, at the end of next month?
There really isn't. I think what you should do is plan for higher prices, and then you'll be happy even if the prices fall.
Does that work for business as well? I mean, it's fine for consumers, but can business do that?
Well, I think we need to recognize that we don't control prices anymore. There was a time when the U.S. had a lot of strategies in price to really buffer prices, and one of them was refinery inventories, and one of them was the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and one was our relationship with Saudi Arabia. One was a real strong emphasis on energy efficiency. We've basically kind of lost all of that, partly because of changes in the oil market, partly because we just let things slide. So, I think that we need to realize that we don't control price until we put some policies in place that are really going to buffer those. We don't really have that much influence, and our main influence is taking our foot off the gas. I would like to say one other thing about offshore drilling that really burns me up that never gets talked about. You know, when oil gets pulled out of offshore, federal lands offshore, the U.S. government or the taxpayers' take is about 50% of the profits. But when U.S. oil companies are drilling in Nigeria or Algeria or Kazakhstan or Russia, they have to pay about 90% of the profits, sometimes more than 90% of the profits, to the host country. So, you know, when we okay this federal drilling, we're kind of saying, like, yeah, go ahead, make profits.
Yeah, please rip
us
off.
Sell it to us at the world price.
Yeah.
Well, and that's certainly another segment that we'll have you come back and talk about, is that some of the subsidies of the oil industry here in the United States. Lisa Marganelli, we're always so pleased to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa Marganelli, she is the author of the book about the oil supply chain, Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long, Strange Trip to Your Tank, and she is our friend here at The Takeaway.
Kick me, I'm a taxpayer. It might be the slogan for
I
that
think
offshore drilling policy.
We do that segment.
Policy.
We talk about
indeed.
That, absolutely.
We're now going to continue with a series of conversations that we've been having over the last few weeks about the really important trial that's opened down at Guantanamo Bay, the trial of Salim Hamdan, who's alleged alleged to be Osama bin Laden's former driver and is at the center of the at least justice element of the war on terror. The trial is going on down at Guantanamo. We've had a number of discussions about what's gone on in the courtroom. Joining us now is Jonathan Mahler, who's an author and New York Times contributing writer, and his book, The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, comes out next month. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, you have a piece in this Sunday's New York Times which makes some compelling sort of broad statements about the significance of this trial, but I want to begin with, did you think when you got involved in this particular case that it would have the significance that it's coming to have and it seems to be having now?
I actually really had no idea. I mean, the book grew out of a story I wrote for the Times Magazine back in the spring of 2004, and the story was in fact a profile of the Navy lawyer, the JAG lawyer, who was appointed by the Pentagon to represent Hamdan.
It's Commander Swift?
Exactly, Lieutenant Commander Charlie Swift, who's since left the military after not getting promoted.
Who is an amazing character.
Yeah, he's a great figure, and I wrote this profile of him. He was just an incredibly compelling guy. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy, sort of struggled through the Naval Academy, but then sort of found his way, went to not an elite law school, and sort of struggled through law school, but really kind of came into his own as a defense lawyer in the military, and was just an incredibly zealous defense lawyer who got very close to his clients. And so I was just so interested in his relationship with Hamdan, this idea that a Navy officer would have to kind of earn the trust of an accused terrorist, not just an accused terrorist, someone who had worked directly for bin Laden.
But also to take this on as a cause and challenge
Absolutely.
The entire
Yep.
government.
Yep. It really was the end of his military career, obviously, among other things, including his marriage. But when I got involved, I was really mostly sort of caught up in that element of it. And at the time, they had just he and this law professor at Georgetown, Neil Katyal, constitutional law professor, whom Swift had brought on board, had just filed suit against the government over the lawfulness of these military tribunals. But back in 2004, it didn't even look like the federal courts were going to even be able to hear challenges from Guantanamo.
So it's made it to the Supreme Court. There have
been
any number of challenges. There's a parallel case of Hamdan in federal court as well as the military tribunal. We're going to talk about some of those procedural issues, and I'm dying to get your impressions of the actual trial as it's gone on. We're going to keep you with us and bring you in just a moment. Jonathan, hold on there on the phone, all right?
Sure.
Jonathan Mahler is author and New York Times contributing editor. We're talking to him about his book, The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. His book comes out next month. You know, the Hamdan case is such an interesting window
on
the Bush administration.
And he has such a huge view of not only the big picture, but the intricacies of all of the small pieces that make up that big picture.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about how it links or not with the Nuremberg trial, because it's the last time there was a military tribunal like this. It was the Nuremberg trial.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today is Thursday, and it is the very last day in July. And many people know this is a tough economic times, or I should say many people are suffering under these tough economic times. And when you're listening to music, what's that song that helps you get through these times as they are? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Playlist for hard times. But continuing now on our conversation with Jonathan Mahler, who's a New York Times contributing writer and author of the book The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Jonathan, you know, we've been checking in with the actual proceedings of the trial all this week, and Ben Wisner of the ACLU delivered an impression yesterday that I wanted to ask you about. He thought that in the court proceedings, it appeared as though Hamdan started out as a cooperative witness for the prosecution and the Bush administration, and that they eventually decided to just kind of bail on whatever evidence he was giving them to convict others and just sort of convict him, go after him, cannibalize their own witness.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in during the course of my research for the book, I interviewed at length his Hamdan's sort of lead FBI interrogator, Ali Soufan, who was also sort of the FBI's kind of foremost expert on al-Qaeda. And Soufan, you know, built a relationship with Hamdan and got a lot of information from him, a lot of intelligence from him. And it was his impression and his hope that the government would actually use him as a witness, get him to offer a guilty plea in exchange for cooperation, and that they would use him as a witness during the trials of some of the bigger fish, the sort of more senior al-Qaeda leaders. But instead, the United States actually decided to try Hamdan himself. So I think that came as a big surprise to him. Yeah.
What's your impression? Is Hamdan a bad guy?
Well, certainly, it's indisputable that he was a driver for bin Laden, you know, there are other issues that are, and also I think one can pretty safely say that he was some sort of bodyguard. He was driving bin Laden. He was carrying a weapon. And then you have a lot of issues that are in dispute about whether he swore an oath of loyalty to bin Laden. It's quite possible that he did. I don't have the impression that he was at all involved in any specific attacks, or that he was necessarily, totally committed to the cause. So mm-hmm. I guess I would say, you know, in answer to that question, yes, I think he's guilty to an extent, for sure. But do I think that he's the appropriate defendant for America's first war crimes trial since World War II, and sort of a symbol of the sort of the power of the rule of law, the right guy to be putting on trial right now? I'm not sure he is.
And Jonathan, I'm glad you said exactly that, because that would be my question. His link to Osama bin Laden, clearly there is one. How high does it go and how significant is it? Seems to be really overshadowed by the questions of the Bush administration's policy and notion of executive power in triggering these military tribunals, in which they've been rebuked 3 times by the Supreme Court.
Right. That's the real problem. I mean, the real problem is that, you know, we're now 7 years removed from 9/11, and nearly 7 years removed from the authorization of these military tribunals. They've been tied up in procedural wrangling because the Bush administration insisted on not getting Congress's buy-in, insisted on keeping them out of the reach of the federal courts, so that the federal courts couldn't sign off on these on the rules of these tribunals, and so. You know, basically, what you have at this point is you know, nothing like what we had at Nuremberg, which was this you know, this great monument to the rule of law, and as the chief prosecutor Robert Jackson called it, a sort of a symbol to the triumph of power of reason over power.
Well, this is what's so compelling about your book, and really the piece in this Sunday's New York Times, because you raise what is essentially the puzzle of the entire post 9/11 era for the Bush administration. You know, Nuremberg was consensus, was a world-seeking closure from horrible
exactly.
events.
Right.
This is such a sideshow. There's no
yeah.
consensus. What are they doing? What do
right.
they think they're doing? Do you have any insight?
Problem is that I think you're exactly right, and the problem is that, you know, here we are talking about whether these trials are fair or not, and discussing all the kind of missteps that the Bush administration made along the way, when what's happening, you know, in theory, what we should be talking about is the trial of the perpetrators of the greatest attack on American soil in U.S. history,
right.
and the nation's this historic war crimes trial, which hasn't taken place since World War II, and we're not. We're wondering, are these fair? Is this guy really guilty? Is he worthy of being subjected to this kind of trial? Does he deserve more rights?
And Jonathan, you know, not even fairness in the big picture. We're looking at fairness at every step. Were they
exactly.
fairly rendition? Were they fairly taken, potentially,
you know,
him or others? Were they fairly interrogated? It's like every element of it.
Right. I mean, you figure that you know, this is the first guy they're going to put on trial. You have to assume, and in fact, I did talk to his very first prosecutor who chose Hamdan, that he looked, his profile was pretty good, like his treatment was pretty good. If he's the first guy America's going to put on trial, they know he's the one who's going to get the most attention. And evidence has already been disallowed. Evidence has already been barred. The very first day, the judge barred some of his statements because they've been coerced.
John, we've got to move on, but I just want to leave with this one fabulous story from your book. Can you tell me the story of what Commander Swift, the defense attorney for Hamdan, said to the senators that inspired the editorial in the New York Times, Who We Are.
Yes. Well,
quickly.
What Swift said was essentially that. What he said was during a hearing in the summer of 2005, after Abu Ghraib and during the whole debate over Guantanamo, he said, this isn't about them. This is about us. This is about who we are. And I think we're seeing that sort of every day on Guantanamo.
Our trials in the United States reflect who we are. This commander who thought his military career was over, and he raised a constitutional issue that resonates all throughout the nation today. Jonathan Mahler, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Mahler is the author and New York Times contributing writer of the book, The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Now, headlines from Femi, okay?
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Turkey's ruling AK Party has narrowly escaped a shutdown. Turkey's highest court ruled by one vote to allow the party, accused of having Islamist roots, to continue operation. The head of national intelligence will be getting more power over foreign spying. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. The paper is reporting the Bush administration will unveil a major overhaul of U.S. spy powers today. An FDA official says that the agency has found, and I quote, a smoking gun in the recent salmonella outbreak. Water samples from a pepper farm in Mexico contained the bacteria, but the Mexican government says not so fast. They say the sample water isn't even used at the farm. ... That's actually not the news. That's just me adding some drama.
Punctuation.
Yes.
We call it punctuation here on planet Earth. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome. Trying
to get to the bottom of the salmonella thing.
I'm still working
on
it.
And you had to say dot, 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 because it's radio and we can't see it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
Another selection there on the Takeaway from America's Hard Times playlist. We want your playlist ideas for Hard Times. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That was from Dennis, who wrote to our website to tell us that any 1980s playlist must include Hard Times from Run DMC's first album. He went to high school in New York in the 1980s. Dora?
Yeah, people seem to like the 80s around here. And in the 80s and in the 90s, we were doing a whole lot of reporting about how homeless numbers across the country were rising, and today at a time when the job market is stalling, fuel and food prices are soaring, and Americans are reeling from the home foreclosure crisis, could homelessness rates be going down? Apparently so, or at least according to the Department of Housing and Development. They say 1.6 million people were homeless last year and found shelter. Overall, it says homelessness is down 12% the past several years, chronic homelessness down even more at 30%. For a closer look, joining us now is Michael Stoops, the acting executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless, and Daniel Malone, director of housing for Downtown Emergency Service Centers based in Seattle. Thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Good morning.
Michael, let's start with you. You track the numbers nationwide. Are they really accurate? Is it possible there's been a 12% decline, which is really significant?
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to count the homeless population, and 44% of the nation's homeless are unsheltered, living outside, people who don't even bother to go to the shelter system. So we hope that there really is a decrease, but our network of shelters and soup kitchens and housing programs are seeing an increase in homelessness, and this is even before the full impact of the foreclosure crisis and now the unofficial recession that our country is now in.
How do you think they would come up with numbers like this? Because you're really talking about thousands of people who they're saying have now found homes, according to HUD.
Well, the shelters in this country, they have a computerized intake system, and so people who come to the shelter and seek shelter and services, they're being counted as being helped, and hopefully some of those folks are getting into supportive housing programs. So we have a long ways to go, and we see it increasing despite this recent study saying that the numbers are down.
Daniel, you're in Seattle. When you saw this report and you saw the numbers, I mean, what did you think to yourself?
Well, there's certainly been an approach at the federal level to try to do more in the way of counting individuals and families who are experiencing homelessness. And I guess I wasn't particularly surprised that some of the reporting was coming out with decreases in numbers. It's too early, in my view, to tell for sure whether this represents a trend or, you know, perhaps just a brief fluctuation in the numbers that were coming from the sources that they were using.
Mm-hmm.
In our community, for example, we do an annual count on a single day in late January, where not only people who are staying in shelters are tallied, but there's an extensive street count that happens where hundreds of volunteers fan out in the middle of the night and try to identify as many people as they can who are sleeping outdoors. And unfortunately, in our city and county, we saw a little bit of an increase in the street count this year. Of the total 8,400 people identified as homeless in our community that night, over 2,600 were counted to be sleeping outside. You know, it's just an astronomical number.
And you actually work with the chronically homeless in your city. There have been some improvements that you believe have taken place. Can you describe very quickly some of those improvements?
Sure. So my organization is really set up to work with a subset of the homeless population who are experiencing the most severe problems, and that mainly means individuals with really severe mental illnesses and chronic substance abuse problems. And we've found through housing innovations, specifically programs that are now being referred to mostly as housing first programs, where individuals are selected based on having the greatest vulnerabilities and severest problems and offered a place to live before they have to have stabilized, that they do much better. And not only will they accept housing, but they remain housed once they're inside.
Mm-hmm.
And then other things improve from there. People are more likely to accept psychiatric care, for example.
So get people in homes, and then you can work on the rest of the issues. I've just got a few minutes here. Michael, very quickly, this is really both a professional mission, but also a personal one for you, and that homelessness has affected your family. Could you just tell us that story very quickly?
Well, I've been working with homeless folks for over three decades, and I had my grandfather was an alcoholic, and he froze to death on the streets. I've always had a special empathy for the late-stage chronic alcoholic and some of the folks that Dan is talking about.
And so you're really bracing, though, given all of the foreclosures, that for the numbers to rise, yes or no?
Yes, and we want to make sure that those folks do not join the ranks of the homeless population.
Michael Stoops, Acting Director of the National Coalition for the Homeless in Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
And Daniel Malone, Director of Housing, Downtown Emergency Service Center, which runs the 1811 Eastlake Supportive Housing Project for Chronic Alcoholics in Seattle.
Man,
thank you.
That story of his father.
You're welcome.
Grandfather.
That story. Grandfather. That's just, man.
Now we have some headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Femi.
Thanks, Adore. 20 minutes to the hour. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert will step down in September, and he says he's innocent of corruption charges. He's accused of a long list of financial misdeeds, including taking cash-stuffed envelopes from an American businessman. Iraqi police say that a suicide car bomb attack has killed three people and wounded four others near Mosul. It comes a day after al-Qaeda in Iraq vowed to avenge the killings of fellow militants in the northern city. UN peacekeeping forces are stretched to the limit. That's the warning from their outgoing director, Jean-Marie Guénot. He says that the Blue Helmets are in dire need of new resources if their work to police the world is to continue. And President Bush is tripling US spending to fight AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis in the world's poorest countries. The new bill authorizes $48 billion in aid over the next 5 years. John Hockenbury, why do you have your instrument out on the table?
What, my mandolin?
Yes.
Well, because what's Jack's here. We did some music at the top of the hour.
Will you play something for me?
Not now.
Please.
I said I was putting down
Please,
the mandolin.
Please, Mr. Clavin.
I said I was...
Courage. Well,
do not
that.
You're not supposed to encourage this sort of thing. This is a news program.
And we're going out with some music.
Them me okay is here.
Jack Grace is going to throw in a tune or two. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, right on the spot like that, huh?
Yeah, exactly. That's how we do things here on The Takeaway.
Four,
we're live.
4, 3, 2... One. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and we are assembling America's master playlist for hard times. We've gotten a bunch of responses. Here in the studio with us is Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy, and he's got a song for us. But, you know, what we were doing was trying to get a handle on this economic downturn, and we were looking at little signs. Music is a sign. Cancellations are a sign of things that are going wrong in communities, and we've assembled an enormous list. Adora, you've got a couple on the list there.
Oh, the list is very long. We're going to share a couple, and you can also find this on our website. But in Boston, for example, people riding the T, the subway is way up. There's been many school activities this summer that have been canceled. In Montana High School Basketball Conference, they scrapped that. And some police departments across the country are having their officers get out of the cars and get on foot so they can save on gas.
10 states are cutting Medicare. The free ride at the University of California and California State University System is over. They're raising undergrad fees. And in Duluth, Minnesota, they're not going to operate the Fun Wagon anymore. We have some playlist suggestions from some of you folks. Here's one.
Hi, this is Jason calling from White Plains. For your playlist selections this morning, you might want to consider adding Minimum Wage by They Might Be Giants. A very short track, but very appropriate.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
I love this song.
That works. They Might Be Giants definitely gets us out of the 80s. Here's a suggestion from our listener, Don.
Hi, this is Don Redpath from Mohegan Lake. I'm calling with the Hard Times song, and that's Down Here Below from Steve Earle on a recent album called Washington Square Serenade. Great song.
The life goes on down here below. Lawless motor.
I love Steve Earle.
It's a great selection.
What a nice mix.
Yeah, it's really nice. Mm-hmm. You did a song. Actually, we asked you to put some of the cancellations on our list to music. Jack, can
yes.
you give that a shot?
Sure. I'm going to try to get them all in, so cut me if I go too long. The African World Fest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin is a no-go this year. Citing the lack of ability, raise funds due to increasing economical stress. Oh, the Harbor Fest Music Fest in Wisconsin as well, enjoying 21 years.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
No more music on the water. They had Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, Grand Funk Railroad, and even Blue Oyster Cult. Well, this year the Reaper might be feared. Daytona Beach Seaside Music Theater, all plays are down.
Wow.
But one night they got a show called Daytona's Gotta Dance. Local celebs paired with professional dancers compete to win. I guess it's more exciting than competing to lose. The North Andover Sheep Shearing Festival. Some say don't blame the high price of fuel.
They stopped the sheep shearing?
The last 2 years, they had to move it from its home. Who wants to hang out with sheep behind a school?
You know, clearly this song can go endlessly, Jack. That's
yes.
fantastic. Here, Tom has one more suggestion for our playlist for hard times.
I'm Tom from New York City, and my song would be either Born Under a Bad Sign by Albert King or Down Don't Bother Me by Albert King.
I've been down so long.
Been down so long. Oh, thanks for all your suggestions. We have more coming in at 877-8-MY-TAKE, the playlist for economic hard times, or my take at thetakeaway.org. Thanks for all your suggestions.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now, hold the mandolin. It's time for headlines from Femi Okeng.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the hour. Both political allies and opponents of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert are applauding his decision to step down amid corruption charges. Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni is widely expected to succeed Olmert as Prime Minister. She'd be the second woman to serve in the post. The UN mandate in Iraq runs out in December, but today was the deadline for the White House and Iraqi leaders to agree on what happens after that. Since there's still no deal, they have to make an interim arrangement and let the next US president finalize the plan. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House will unveil a major overhaul of U.S. spy powers today. The new plan will give the Director of National Intelligence broader authority. Mike McConnell currently holds that post. And finally, Senator Obama is not happy with the rapper Ludacris. I don't think he'll make it onto our Hard Times music playlist, but have a listen to this.
Hillary hated on you, so that bitch is irrelevant. McCain don't belong in any chair unless he's paralyzed.
Now, the track is called Politics, Obama is Here. It does actually praise Obama, but an Obama spokesman came out very quickly to criticize the latest lyrics for the misogynist comments about Hillary Clinton and the insults to John McCain and President Bush. So,
and people in wheelchairs, hello?
Oh, goodness me. I don't think Ludacris is really helping Obama. I think he wants him to stay out of the Obama tank for now.
Okay.
I love that tune.
Well,
no, sorry.
Politics go on and on.
Thank you, fam.
You're welcome.
We're going to move on to something really serious, and we're going to introduce it by talking a little bit about reality TV shows. You know what they are. Some of you have probably watched them, but what if you thought your whole life was one?
What if you were watched every moment of your life? What if everyone you knew was pretending? What if your world was make-believe? What if you didn't know it? The Truman Show. Watch what happens.
That was the trailer of the 1998 movie The Truman Show, where Jim Carrey plays a man who slowly realizes that his whole life is being caught on camera, and everyone around him is an actor. Many of you probably recall that film. It may sound like fiction, but Dr. Joel Gold, as well as his brother, Ian Gold, say that for some of their patients, that story really is a reality. Dr. Gold joins us now in our New York studios. Many thanks to you. What is the Truman Show delusion?
Briefly, delusions in general are fixed false beliefs. You can show someone evidence that their belief system is incorrect, and they'll still continue to hold it, though they tend to be quite narrow. I might believe, for instance, that my spouse has been replaced by a double, but the rest of the world exists as it is. However, in the Truman Show delusion, the entire world is counterfeit. Everyone around the patient, their family members, friends, are actors, perhaps the hospital staff and other patients are actors, and everything around the patient is, in fact, a movie set.
Including their doctor. I should add that Dr. Joel Gold is a staff psychiatrist at Bellevue Hospital here in New York City. And how is that really different from, let's say, schizophrenia, where it's about abnormal perceptions of reality?
I need to make it clear that delusions are just symptoms. We are not suggesting that there's a new mental illness by any means. You can be delusional with schizophrenia, as you just mentioned. You can have a delusion if you have bipolar disorder, if you take substances, if you have a medical illness. So it's really just a psychotic symptom. We're describing what we think might be a new kind of delusion, a more all-encompassing one.
Now, would this be something that has happened in the brain, or are patients acquiring a narrative from just observing external sources of entertainment, for instance, reality shows?
Well, that's a very good point, and that's exactly what we're looking at. The cultural zeitgeist has always been sort of incorporated into people's delusional thought systems. Over the course of time, an example again I use, during the Cold War, people might have thought that the KGB was spying on them, and now they may be considering that Al-Qaeda is following them. We think that this, again, is perhaps of greater magnitude in that with the internet, YouTube, reality television, Everything is incorporated into these people's belief systems, and the technology is not going away anytime soon, and unfortunately reality television is not going away anytime soon.
Describe the people that you've been finding yourself believing have this.
Yeah, we initially I treated five young men at Bellevue Hospital from the year 2002 to 2004. They were sort of well-educated, upper-middle-class gentlemen who actually some worked in media. One guy worked on a reality TV show. Another worked in media. And they did believe that everything was, in fact, being filmed.
Were they making up their own reality show and casting themselves in it, or was there like a reality show that was a model for them, like Survivor or Big Brother or something like that?
They felt that everything was scripted, that people would give them signals, that there were cameras everywhere, and that wherever they went, it was sort of preordained. And in that regard, regardless of how dull their life may have been, the whole world was watching them for their enjoyment.
So would you include this in a multiple personality disorder, and would this be treated differently than, say, schizophrenia, as we mentioned, or the bipolar folks who are also suffering from delusions?
We treat the illness, not the symptom per se. So if someone has schizophrenia, we'll treat them as we would any other schizophrenic, with antipsychotic medications and the like, mood stabilizers for people with bipolar disorder. I would not consider it a form of multiple personality. The person themselves, they're the only real person, as Truman Burbank in The Truman Show, he's the only true man. So if I have the Truman Show delusion, I'm Joel Gold. You all are actors playing yourselves.
And so therefore, your ability to convince the patient that, in fact, they're not in a reality show using any sort of persuasive techniques just folds directly into the reality show.
Exactly.
You're the kindly Dr. Gold from
actor,
the TV show.
Exactly. I'm the actor playing Dr. Gold. And it's never easy to convince someone who's delusional, by definition, that their delusion is not true. But I think it's all the more difficult when even family members, doctors, et cetera, can't really talk them out of it.
Why call it the Truman Show delusion? There's almost something comic about that, when it really sounds like it's a torturous situation to be in.
It doesn't sound like you want people making fun of this at all.
Not at all, and I appreciate you guys bringing that up. It does sort of conjure up a frivolous take. Reality television, a movie, it's all very light, but in fact, it is torturous for these individuals. One of the gentlemen came to a federal building and got into a scuffle with a police officer because he was asking for asylum from the show and ended up at Bellevue. Another gentleman became suicidal because he was so at the end of his wits with regard to being taped for years at a time. So
he's still with us, or...?
He is still with us.
That's
yes,
good.
Yes.
I wanted to make that clear. Yes. This really is a story about the power of television, though, in some ways, the power of media.
I believe so. I mean, Andy Warhol said, "In the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes," and the future is now. I can put myself on YouTube doing something absolutely ridiculous, and tomorrow, 10 million people can be watching me. And though I have no ostensible talent, I am, in a sense, famous.
The update might be in the 21st century, if you're only famous for 15 minutes, you're kind of a wuss.
Exactly. You're
right.
You're a failure.
That's
in that
a good
regard.
Point, John. Yeah, exactly. Well, Dr. Joel Gold, we can't thank you enough for coming in and speaking
My
to
pleasure.
Us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Dr. Joel Gold, staff psychiatrist at Bellevue Hospital in New York, came to talk to us about the Truman Show delusion, which he and his brother are investigating, and I'm assuming at some point you're going to write something about.
We're working on it now.
Great. Thank you.
We are always on here at The Takeaway, and we've been assembling America's Master Playlist for Hard Times, and you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with that. Jack, do you have a song for us to take us out?
How about a good old helpless, helpless, helpless.
Helpless. That's a good one.
Baby, can you hear me now?
Can you talk about oil prices along with him on that?
I think that we can. We also have to do a segment about things that people can do to help themselves in the economy.
Right.
Right?
Upbeat songs.
Upbeat.
Useful songs.
Useful
like
songs.
Economically viable songs. We're following oil and
like
oil
prices.
Like I Will
prices. Survive. That's what I'm thinking.
I Will
Gloria
Survive.
Gaynor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
We're also following homeless rates. They've dropped 12% in recent years. This is all the kinds of stuff that we want you to comment on in the show. And also hard times. Tomorrow, on the program. We're going to go to North Dakota, where we follow in the line of what you're talking about, an oil boom.
Oil.
As it happens to a small community in North Carolina. We want to hear from you. Send your playlist for Hard Times to 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
And also, what issue are you talking about? Maybe we haven't noted it, but, you know, send us a note. Maybe there's something in there that we are missing, and we'd want to hear what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE. And I think John has just picked up his mandolin, so I think we might be in for a little bit of a
duet. I'm helpless, Jack.
Take
us out.
And I'll sing. Just kidding.
Baby, helpless, helpless, helpless.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.